I want to begin by observing that many people who express concern about the effects of mass media tend to focus on the content and the ideas, how mass media influence our thinking about various things. And the content is worth attending to, but I don't think the content is as influential in our lives as the forms that mass media take. And I will be talking about those forms, some of those effects also, in this talk. How the content of mass media might affect what we think and believe is finally, I think, not as influential as how mass media affect how we think and believe, how we have emotions, and how we intuitively understand what we are. And I think the theological rationale for this observation would be the fact that that we are bodies and spirits. We're not simply minds processing information, but as integrated beings, things that happen in our embodied experience affects our thinking, affects our assumptions about reality. In each of the four lectures I've given here, I'm trying to encourage you to give attention to ways in which your own experience with cultural forms, and in this one especially with mass media, shapes how you think about yourself, relationships with friends and family, relationship with God. We're used to making this stark distinction between form and content, and I think that distinction is often cited in the various worship wars debates where people say, well, we're not changing content, we're just changing form. We might think, for example, that what we read is more important than the device that delivers it. So if you needed to read an essay for a class, you might find it in a book that you have to check out of the library, or you might buy the book, or it might be posted online, or a friend might have a photocopy of it that you can borrow. It's all the same content. But imagine that you could only read a copy of the essay if you went to a rare book room in the library, a hidden room you didn't even know existed. You had to make an appointment. You had to show up at a certain time. You had to show an ID. You had to take notes by hand. The content would be the same, but your relationship with the content of the essay would feel very different because of the form of your approach to it. You might resent the hassle of the procedure, or you might pay more attention to the content of the essay. You might see things you hadn't seen otherwise because of the rarity of the experience. Imagine similarly that someone you really love goes away for a year, and he or she goes somewhere where there isn't any email, no instant messaging, no cell phones, no telephones at all. The only way to communicate is by letter. And it takes a week for a letter to get there and a week for the response to come back. The form that your communication took would shape your relationship to the content of those letters. You would write them differently than if you were just sending email. It would influence how you scheduled your time to write the letters. It would influence how much time you put into writing it, how careful you were to express yourself concisely, clearly, expressively. The form that the communication took might even have an influence on the shape of your relationship over time. It might be that you realize you can't sustain a relationship if you didn't have instant messaging, which would be a good thing to know before you got married. Oh, why was I presupposing you were married? I don't know. We usually ignore the form that communications take because we're used to them, or because we have lots of choices and we choose the one that's most convenient for the moment. And because we're so matter-of-fact about forms, we don't realize how those forms smuggle things into our experience without our realizing it. We don't realize how we're being shaped by the things, by how things are communicated to us. I heard recently of a course in the humanities taught, I think it was University of Kansas, which required students to memorize some poetry, but they weren't allowed to consult a book to memorize the poems. They had to find someone who'd taken the course the previous year and learn it by oral tradition. Because the professors who organized the course didn't just want the students to learn the content of the poems or memorize the poems. They wanted them to learn something about the nature of oral tradition, about how the spoken word lives in relationships, which is, after all, the way our oldest literature was passed on. And in order to learn that, they had to change the form of communication. How we receive communication, whether it's information or entertainment or art, has a greater effect on us than we realize. I'm willing to bet that in all the examples I've given you, you may have been thinking at one point what it would be like to experience those things, and I'm sure that the inconvenience of those restricted forms would be something that you would think would be frustrating, and how frustrating it was not to have choices, particularly, not to be able to choose how you how the communication is to happen. Mass media is a lot about choice. It's not just about the distribution more efficiently of content, but it's about expanding the range of choices of experiences that people can have. And I think I want to reflect for just a minute on how it affects our sense of what our lives are about, that we have so many choices, that in fact millions of people in thousands of companies spend their time making available to us more and more choices about how we can spend our time. Whether we're watching television or browsing online or listening to the radio or driving past billboards or just talking to friends whose clothing displays all sorts of logos, at any given moment, we live in a media ecosystem that is, in the words of one critic, firing message modules aimed straight for your taste buds, your vanities, your fears. Some of the most talented people on the planet have devoted their lives to creating a psychic sauna in which we're being addressed for many of our waking hours, and for some people, almost all of their waking hours, being addressed by the opportunity to attend to something. They only want your attention for a second. They know you're busy. But there's a certain sense in which I think we're kind of flattered. I think at some deep level, we like having all these, although they can be annoying. At some deep level, I think we like being attended to in this way, being spoken to. Ellen Ullman, a software engineer and essayist, wrote an essay about seeing a billboard show up in her neighborhood in San Francisco. She described the billboard on a background of brilliant sky blue, was writing in airy white letters, which said, "Now the world really does revolve around you." The letters were lower-cased, soft-edged, spaced irregularly as if they'd been skywritten over a hot August beach and were already drifting off into the air. The message they left behind was a child's secret wish, the ultimate baby world narcissism we're all supposed to abandon when we grow up. The world really does revolve around me. Now, it turns out this was a billboard for a company that made semiconductors. And Ullman thought, who else but someone in the computer industry could make such a shameless appeal to individualism? She actually worked as a software. She wrote software manuals, so these were her own people. She writes, "The billboard loomed over the corner for the next couple of weeks. Every time I passed it, its message irritated me more. It bothered me the way the My Computer icon bothers me on the Windows desktop. Baby names like My Yahoo, My Snap, My, 2-year-old talk, infantilizing and condescending." And Ullman observed that this billboard was doing what every other piece of advertising does. It whispers into your ear that there's no one like you in the whole world. What we're offering is for you, special you, you alone. Toyota was using a slogan for a while, "It's not for you, it's not for everyone, just for you." It's kind of an amazing thing in mass media to use an allegedly personalized appeal. We ought to see through those things. The content of many of the messages we see in advertising is obviously flattering. You deserve a break today. Have it your way. The old L'Oreal, because I'm worth it. There's a kind of implicit, explicit appeal to a kind of narcissism. I go to Amazon and I can click on the tab for Ken's store. They have a store named after me, Ken's store. Now, because this ego-centered appeal is so obvious, we kind of are cynical about it. We kind of dismiss it ironically. We know it's not really somebody has set up a store just for me. But we assure ourselves that we're not as gullible as that, don't we? Are we? Deep down, I have to wonder. These people have done research on this. They have highly trained psychologists figuring this all out. And so I have to wonder, does all that flattery affect us even when we are dismissing it? And more subtly, how are we affected by the proliferation of choices that we have, many of which come to us in mass media? Even if the advertising copy isn't so obsequious, the very fact that so many options are presented to us may affect our sense of how important we are. Thomas de Zengatita, who wrote a book called Mediated, which is, again, on the effects of mass media. De Zengatita is actually trained as a cultural anthropologist and in philosophy. But he believes that having so many choices presented to us does give us a sense of a kind of sovereignty. When I interviewed him a year or so ago, he said, it was kind of amazingly candid. He said, I'm in my early 60s. I have friends who are starting to show signs of mortality. And I'm always surprised when they're offended by the fact that they didn't have a choice. You know, here they are approaching death, the ultimate no choice situation, and they're offended by it. A lot of his book, Mediated, is about this whole idea of the proliferation of choices removing us from the sense that there are any necessities, removing us from the sense that there's something we have to submit to, even death. Having lots of choices makes us feel more powerful, more enabled, more like sovereigns. The modern ideal of freedom is to give people more and more and more choices. Thought experiment. If you went to a restaurant and they only had two things on the menu, but you knew every time you went, those two things were always really good food, would you prefer that to a restaurant where you had 30 things on the menu and it was all mediocre food? My hunch is there are a lot of people who want the 30 items, that they would prefer the choice to the good food because the act of choosing is such a powerful good. The restriction of our freedom is something that we really balk at. Even when we're in a good space, even when we're in a good kind of setting. You know, the difference between dogs and cats, I'm told, that dogs... a dog looks at his master and says, wow, he gives me food, he gives me toys, he plays with me, he grooms me, he must be a god. And a cat looks at his master and says, wow, he gives me food, he gives me toys, he plays with me, he grooms me, I must be a god. Surrounded by a superabundance of choices, very few of us feel like dogs. We don't feel humble that we live in a world where things have been taken care of us this way. We tend to feel empowered, whether or not we actually are. We don't regard the people who provide us with those choices as special and worthy. We feel that we're special and worthy to be addressed so deliberately, so earnestly, and so creatively. We know intellectually that when celebrities look at the camera and talk about shampoo or shoes or frozen food, that they don't really care about our well-being. But we live in a fog of perpetual flattery that's so constant that I think many of us feel neglected if we have to go without those kinds of appeals for several days at a time. As De Zengatita puts it, today your brain is full of stuff that was designed to affect you, as opposed to the scattered furniture of nature and history that people once registered just because it happened to be there. The amount of well-engineered appeals to our vanity, to our fear, to our sense of empowerment, to our volition, is unprecedented. And that's got to have some kind of effect on us. It affects our moral horizons. I talked in the last lecture about MySpace and YouTube. This reminds me, I have a friend who teaches at UVA, University of Virginia, and who said that he's a sociologist, and he was talking with class recently about MySpace. He's actually working on an essay on the sociology of this, and he asked the class about the possible problem of vanity that might be encouraged by this. And almost none of the students knew what he was talking about. Vanity was not... One guy said, well, you mean Vanity Fair magazine? Is it something to do with that? The vice of vanity was not on their radar. And when he explained it to them, they were kind of perplexed. Well, gee, huh? Why would that be a problem? Again, not because they've been indoctrinated into some alternate set of some alternate conceptual universe. He believes that there's a sense in which certain concepts simply kind of wither away and are blown away in the wind when they don't seem resonant with the kinds of everyday experience we have. So our idea of freedom as the multiplication of choices, rather than freedom to do what is right, is amplified, given plausibility, by the fact that we are given more and more choices every day. Again, we don't think about these things. We don't think about the fact that we have all these flattering appeals, but at some level I think that we're encouraged to have that sense of sovereignty. Each of these moments is encouraging us to make a choice so that we become more attached to our choosing than to the necessity of submitting to necessity in a good way. Our wills are engaged by these all these choices we're asked to make. And with so many choices, with everything seeming optional, we feel that any limit that we may encounter is an unwarranted assault on our freedom. Our internet access is down, and even if we don't need to go online, we feel deprived in some way. This is all confessional, by the way. This is not accusatory. These are the things I struggle with. I'm not really missing anything I need, but I want the choice to be able to go online if I just wanted to, not that I needed to. I just want the choice. So the messages we receive are explicitly flattering, but the media through which we receive them is always implicitly flattering. By allowing and encouraging so many choices, so much customization, so many personal mixes, that's a really interesting phenomena of mass media. Now, you used to go and buy an album and you had to listen to all 12 cuts on the album or on the cassette or on the CD. Now, people download individual songs and they put together their personal mixes. They put together their own playlists. And if you didn't have the freedom to put your own playlist together, that would seem like a violation of some basic human right. So I think we're in a situation now where we are, with apologies to the Army, everybody's experiencing a culture of one, where we kind of think that the best way to live is to rearrange all of these experiences on our own terms, and again, not to submit to any kind of necessity. Any kind of order that preceded your own desires. If we had more time, we would pause for 5 minutes of silent reflection about what this means in the ministry and what this means. If people with this kind of consciousness coming into your church who are part of a community, what kinds of problems? That's the homework assignment after the lecture. What kinds of problems does this kind of consciousness have for being part of a community? Through mass media, again, we are encouraged to think that we are sovereign. And I think that's more important than the actual messages that are conveyed by the mass media, which people fret over. It's more this kind of sensibility of sovereignty. There are fewer and fewer occasions in which we must yield to necessity or to duty or to suffering. And when we come to believe that we do deserve a break today, we find it hard to believe that we should take up a cross today. Microsoft's slogan for a while, I don't know if it was Microsoft or Windows, where do you want to go today? That was a slogan for Windows. Where do you want to go today? The implication being anywhere you want to go would be a good thing to go, not where should you go today or where ought I go today. Again, the assumption is that we have a kind of sovereignty, which is really the opposite of being a disciple, really the opposite of the kind of surrender of self that discipleship calls us to. So we think of ourselves as sovereign and as consumers, as people who kind of assemble an identity through buying things and making those kinds of choices. This has clearly affected the church as well. Church leaders in the last two decades have routinely been told that they need to be more market-driven. That is, they need to appeal to people in their role as consumers of religious services. Several years ago, I heard of a prominent church leader who said what an insight it was to him to realize that everything could be treated as a commodity. Everything could be treated as a commodity. And so he liked the idea of viewing parishioners, viewing his congregation as a consumer of a service. His preaching was a commodity. The gospel was a commodity. Salvation was a commodity in some sense. And there's a sense in which that could be true. By the way, that was Ted Haggard who said that in an interview. And I felt there was something deeply disordered about saying that a minister saying that everything can be treated as a commodity. It seemed to me to be kind of an ethically tenuous and dangerous kind of position to take. And I'm not saying there's any causal relationship between his problems and that kind of mentality, but I have to wonder that's not a good way to think about our ethical lives, is that we are essentially consumers. And again, it's true that everything can, in a sense, be regarded as a commodity, but since one of the rules of the marketplace is that the customer is always right, it's an odd principle on which to order the life of the church that is striving to submit to its Lord. There is a sense in which we can think of ourselves as only consumers. We are, in a sense, consumers of the love of our parents or of the services of our teachers or consumers of the insights of our pastors or consumers of the teaching of the Scriptures. But I think that that's not a good paradigm. It's not a good model, not a good analogy to use to describe our lives in most of their functions. According to the biblical picture of life, we're first of all not consumers, but receivers of gifts. What do we have that we've not been given? That's what Paul says. Not what do we have that we haven't chosen. What do we have that we have not been given? When he talks about the gifts of the Spirit, he says we're given the gifts for the building up of the body. We're not given the gifts because they fit our lifestyle or because we want them or even because they're best for our own self-fulfillment. We're given gifts for the building up of the body. All of creation is a gift. God didn't have to make anything. He had no necessity of creating. And so every aspect of creation is itself a gift, not a commodity. He created not because he needed to or because we wanted him to, but as an act of love, an act of giving love. And so all that we have, including who we are, comes from God as a mysterious and undeserved gift. Our identity is not something we sovereignly choose. Our identity is something that we are graciously bestowed, and it's not principally for our benefit. So at the core of all of creation is the dynamic of love expressed through gift, which works against the dominant model of choosing, the dominant model of me as a sovereign chooser. Back in the early 1990s, there was a book written by Alan Ehrenhalt about the decline of communal life in America. And he attributed some of the problem in communal life to the preoccupation that Americans have with expanding the range of choices in every sphere of their lives. The worship of choice, he wrote, has brought us a world of restless dissatisfaction in which nothing we choose seems good enough to be permanent, and we are unable to resist the endless pursuit of new selections in work, in marriage, in front of the television set. Now I would say on the internet. Restless dissatisfaction. Having the assumption that we have this cornucopia of choices does not lead to a sense of contentment. It leads to a sense of restlessness. Having very little sense of the obligation to yield gracefully to necessity creates, again, that sense of our believing that we always have to take the initiative, we always have to be the ones choosing. I'm not saying we don't make choices. I'm not saying that choice is not a good thing. In fact, I think volition is actually part of our human identity. But when we see ourselves principally as choosers, or exclusively as choosers, Nietzsche wrote a book called The Triumph of the Will. He was describing modernity's assumption that we are exhausted by our volition, that our identity is exhausted by our volition. Well, we become exhausted in the sense of restlessness, but. So we are much more than will. So again, I don't want to say that we shouldn't have a volitional don't really have a volitional component in our lives. The forms of mass media affect us in subtle ways, which are as influential as the content. The content can present us with ideas and values explicitly stated, but the way we experience mass media conveys a set of implicit assumptions about the world and our identity, our place in the world. I want to look at one other aspect of the forms of mass media, how the tempo of mass media directs us towards certain desires and certain frustrations. The pace of mass media shapes a range of expectations in our lives, and we frame our beliefs and convictions about how we should live based on this set of expectations, which we absorb unconsciously by being immersed in the insistent flow of mass media. I did bring a book. As I mentioned yesterday, I've been given the gift of bibliography, so I have to do this. Media Unlimited by Todd Gitlin. I think it's about 10 years old now. How the Torrent of Images and Sounds Overwhelms Our Lives, a book I would recommend to pastors or pastors in training, because I think it does help, again, grasp the cultural setting in which you're ministering and make explicit a lot of things you probably already kind of implicitly sense. I'll be citing that book in these remarks. And I want to unpack this in four phases. First, I want to look at the way in which our embodied experiences shape our inner lives. So some theological reflection about why our experience of time particularly is not something we can treat with indifference. And then I want to take a quick look at the addiction to speed that's been evolving in American culture for centuries. Then the specific role that mass media plays in feeding the addiction to speed. And finally, how that set of phenomena affects our effort to be faithful disciples of Jesus Christ. The Reformed tradition tells us that the chief end of man is to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. When our lives are properly ordered around that chief end, it turns out that we enjoy our own lives more as well. We were created to experience blessedness, fulfillment, shalom, the highest levels of well-being, only as our lives in all aspects, heart, soul, mind, and strength, are properly oriented, positioned, postured, ordered before God. We glorify and enjoy God in our embodied lives, not as disembodied spirits, not just in our minds, but through specific forms of lived life in space and time in which God has placed us. Adam and Eve loved God and lived for and with Him as they tended a garden. And each of us is called to an involvement in the common reality of living in space and time, but in specific places, with particular kinds of bodies, within the pattern of the order of creation. Creation and its textures and structures, creation is the medium through which, the setting within which, we know God and love God and serve God. Again, we don't have this relationship with God in an abstraction. And it's as we order our lives in space and time that our desires are shaped, our beliefs take root, and our hearts are directed either toward God or away from Him. Honor God in your bodies, Paul says. Paul's actually a great theologian of the body. People thought because he had a negative view of fornication that he didn't like the body. It's amazing how often he talks about the body as the sphere within which our obedience occurs, not the immaterial part of our lives. To be an embodied creature means that we have the challenge of ordering the way that we live in space and time. For example, people talk about the importance of community. But we sometimes run the risk of making community into an abstraction, just a quality of feeling in relationships. But community is experienced in space and time. Community takes time. True human community happens when a small enough group of people share a small enough amount of space and a large enough amount of time to make a serious difference in each other's lives. I quoted Eugene Peterson before. Peterson believes that congregations shouldn't be much more than 150 in size. He believes that congregations that to have real community, there's a natural kind of limit to that. And I recently heard some research in some kind of neurobiology that suggests that because of the way our brains are wired, there are only so many close relationships we can sustain in a course of time. So there actually is there's a built-in concrete reality in our embodiment, which means that we can only sustain a certain number of deep, committed relationships. And time is essential. There was a time when the phrase quality time was being used. And do people talk about quality time anymore? It was kind of a thing in the 80s when parents beginning to feel guilty about not spending more time with their kids. In fact, Doonesbury had a little quip about it once when the phrase was becoming to be a very popular jargon. And Gary Trudeau had some character saying, hey, this quality time works with kids. Does it work with old people too? Trying to figure out as if it was some kind of magic thing. Well, in fact, quantity time is pretty important in the nature of things. You can use time well, but there is a sense in which community, love, relationships take time. It's not no accident that the two of the fruit of the Spirit are temporal virtues. Patience and long-suffering suggests that we need to be oriented a particular way in time. Because we're not disembodied spirits, we have bodies. And how we live in those bodies matters as much to our glorifying and enjoying God and the loving of our neighbors as does what we do with our minds. As believers, we are eager to speak of the timeless and the eternal, but we often forget that the biblical account of human life is one in which our embodiment generally and our temporality specifically is seen as the setting in which God blesses us. From the very beginning, the Bible presents us with a divinely shaped cosmos in which human beings are meant to enjoy the rhythms of creation. Long before the giving of the commandment to keep Sabbath, God established an essentially anthropocentric rhythm in the whole universe. The sun and the moon and the stars, we read in Genesis 1:14, are for signs and for seasons and for days and years. We're to perceive them as ordering our lives in some way. The sun and the moon are identified as rulers in that text. They are assigned a specific dominion long before man is given a dominion later in that chapter. The observance of the Sabbath is just one instance of a general pattern of ordered time, a pattern that's built into creation. And all human cultures have recognized some temporal pattern in creation, which is why all religions have holy days of one kind or another. Modern culture, by contrast, denies, both in theory and in practice, that the cosmos have any patterns that societies would do well to observe. And so we pride ourselves that we live 24/7. In a patternless rush. The pursuit of convenience and efficiency is more valued by us than the recognition of some divinely established cosmic order. But when the order that the Lord has established in creation is no longer honored by our bodies as well as by our minds, then the Lord of creation and redemption himself is gradually easier to ignore. How we treat time matters because our embodiment matters. We're not apprentice angels aspiring toward disembodied perfection. Believing in the resurrection of the body, we strive on this side of glory to be faithful to the order that God has established for blessed embodiment. So we're commanded by Paul to honor God in our bodies, to present our bodies a living sacrifice. How we live in space and time matters. It's rare to hear Christians talk about honoring God in their ordering of time. Occasionally hear a sermon on the Sabbath. It's interesting that Christians argue with each other about how old the earth is and how many hours it took God to make the world. But I wish a fraction of the energy put into those debates was put into reflecting on the significance of the fact that we're told God took time to make things. And then he established rhythms within the creation for our benefit. We're often eager to insist on the fact of creation, even as we're prone to ignore the meaning and the significance of the order of creation. How do we live well temporally? How do we honor the gift that temporality is in the way we structure our lives? Creation is properly and beautifully temporal. Some early Christian theologians were nervous about this because they'd inherited a Greek metaphysic and ethic which said that change is inherently a problem. But God creates a world that has temporality and in which change is not inherently a problem. Many things find their perfection in time rather than the Greek idea of perfection being timeless, a kind of timeless sphere, I guess. Music, great example. Music finds its perfection in time. Music takes time to be what it is. I think that the Bible has a pretty high view of music. It seems it's the only thing for sure we know we'll do in our eternal state. So time isn't a burden or a barrier. Time is a great blessing. We couldn't have poetry. We couldn't have dance. We couldn't have stories. We couldn't have the delight of celebrating birthdays or anniversaries if we didn't have time. But we think of time as an obstacle because we don't have enough time to do what we want to do. I mentioned Psalm 1 in the last lecture, one of my favorite psalms, which is a psalm about time. It describes a righteous man as being like a tree planted by streams of water that yields its fruit in its season. Its leaf does not wither. If you've ever planted a tree, especially a fruit tree, you know that it's very different from the world of online shopping carts and FedEx trucks. In some ways, a more attractive world to us. The idea that you plant a tree that takes time to be what it is and to bring the blessing that it is increasingly frustrating for us. And yet, the roots of those trees have to become established to benefit from the proximity of that stream. And the psalmist is telling us here that our righteousness is like that. It's something that takes time to acquire. And it becomes timeless in its obedience. The leaves don't wither precisely because of the fact that it took time to get there. So again, we are beings who find our perfection in time. The modern attitude toward time could be summed up in a single word, and that is efficiency. With the coming of industrialization, the West began its love-hate relationship with speed. Machines enable things to be done faster, and they've given us more leisure. But they've also encouraged an attitude that we ought to do more and more. Ironically, they're supposed to be labor-saving devices. And we're more rushed. The more labor-saving devices we get, the more rushed we feel. It's kind of like the spirit of the Tower of Babel. We think we should be able to do more and more to prove how godlike we are. This concern about being rushed is not a new concern. It shows up not long after the Industrial Revolution. In 1882, some time after industrialization had transformed European culture forever, Friedrich Nietzsche wrote, "One is ashamed of resting, and prolonged reflection almost gives people a bad conscience." I hope you, as those of you studying for the ministry, don't feel that way. You may be tempted to. But I would hope your parishioners realize that they're paying you for prolonged reflection and not just getting things done in a hurry. Nietzsche said, "One thinks with a watch in one's hand. Even as one eats one's midday meal while reading the latest news of the stock market, one lives as if one might miss out on something. Virtue has come to consist of doing something in less time than anyone else." This is Friedrich Nietzsche. He was actually a wise observer of the disorder of our time. Along with the driving concern for efficiency that industrialization produced came a preoccupation with novelty, an interest in and preference for new things just because they were new. C.S. Lewis observed in his inaugural address in 1954 that because new machines usually were more efficient than old machines, people in industrialized societies came to prefer the new to the old in all areas of life. How has it come about, Lewis asked rhetorically, that we use the highly emotive word stagnation with all of its malodorous and malarial overtones for what other ages would have called permanence? Why does the word primitive at once suggest to us clumsiness, inefficiency, barbarity, when our ancestors talked of the primitive church or the primitive purity of our Constitution? They meant nothing of that sort. The answer, Lewis claimed, of the change in the way we use these words, a change of attitudes toward time, is in the cultural centrality of machines, of a pattern of life dedicated to efficiency in which new things replaced old things with greater and greater frequency and accomplished more things. So efficiency came to govern our attitude toward time, and the preference for novelty meant that many people in Western cultures began to take pleasure in change for its own sake. Just the experience of change had a pleasurable quality about it. Not necessarily because the change meant some kind of automatic improvement, not because they believed that they were evolving to something better necessarily, but change was good as such. Change seemed to imply that we were moving, advancing. Whether or not the change was in any objectively good direction, it felt good to many people to experience change. It felt modern, and modern was good. We're talking now about the late 19th century, early 20th century. While the wealthy had long had the leisure to cultivate an interest in novelty, and so early became captive in the desire to be fashionable, to be up with the times in manner of speech and dress, the lower classes didn't worry much about being fashionable. Worrying about survival tended to be more important. But by the turn of the 20th century, more and more people were beginning to show an interest in the latest things. We have some interesting observations from a turn of the century, a German sociologist named Jörg Simmel, S-I-M-M-E-L, who, writing in 1904, argued that a concern for being fashionable had become more common in popular settings as, and here's how he put it, as permanent, unquestioned convictions increasingly lose their force. 1904. Permanent, unquestioned convictions increasingly are losing their force, and hence people are preoccupied with what's fashionable. In this way, he wrote, the fleeting and changeable elements of life gain that much more free space. The break with the past increasingly concentrates consciousness upon the present. The emphasis upon the present is clearly, at the same time, an emphasis upon change. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not suggesting change is bad. But the modern desire for change for its own sake, and this is a new thing. My daughter's a major in medieval and Renaissance studies, and we were talking about this recently, what a remarkably new idea this is. One of the things that distinguishes the modern culture, that's Lewis saw that very clearly, this desire for change for its own sake is a problem insofar as it involves an inner restlessness and a denial of the permanent. Zimmel uses the word fleeting. To be fleet means to be fast. To be fleeting means to be temporary. And a preoccupation with speed often reflects both a dissatisfaction with the permanent and a preference for the disposable. Social changes tied to new technologies meant new experiences for people, as they do today. Riding on trains for the first time, if you can imagine that, moving faster through a landscape than you ever could on a horse, that meant that the landscape sped by in a previously unimaginable way. Getting into an airplane for the first time meant a new experience of space and time. Electricity rearranged the ordering of time because of the fact that you could light things up at night. It brought all sorts of new sensations in lighted displays. Just reading last night, actually, a quote from G.K. Chesterton, who came to New York and saw Times Square and was rather disappointed because it used to be that magnificent light pointed to some transcendent and spiritual thing. Now it was pointing to watches or, you know, motor oil or, you know, something really mundane. He was kind of frustrated that all this glory was being squandered on something really trivial. So electricity, again, brought out these new kinds of sensations. The telegraph brought what must have been an initially disorienting sensation of instant communication with someone thousands of miles away. We take this for granted. I take my cell phone. I can call anywhere. I have this instant relationship with somebody who's, you know, in a different part of the world and a different time of the day. Imagine how it felt to people who first experienced it. What a disorienting sense it was. In 1931, historian James Truslow Adams summarized some of the paradoxical effects on the psyche of people living through those changes, and he focused on their sense of time. It is the number of these sensations and adjustments in a given time that makes the tempo of life. As the number of sensations increase, the time which we have for reacting to and digesting them becomes less. The rhythm of our life becomes quicker. Such a life tends to become a mere search for more and more exciting sensations, undermining yet more our power of concentration in thought. Relief from fatigue and ennui is sought in mere excitation of our nerves, as in speeding cars or emotional movies, or in Game Boys, I would add. Now, so far I've argued the way we think and feel about time, the way we arrange our experience of time, should be guided by the fact that God has ordered time, and that time is better understood as a gift to be received rather than an undesirable limit. And then I've tried to summarize in a shockingly fast survey how modern culture establishes its distinctive attitude toward time through the goal of efficiency, the celebration of change, and the thirst for novelty. To be truly modern is to prefer the fleet and the fleeting. And that brings us to the role that mass media play. So far I've been talking mostly about other technologies. I want to look for a minute at the role mass media plays in an accelerated and accelerating world. Mass media don't so much deliver information as they form desires. Mass media forms desires for things, which is the business of advertising, but we also experience desire for love, for acceptance, for pleasure, for security, for power, for happiness. Mass media, both as a resource, is both a resource in meeting the modern need for speed. You know, I want instant communication. I want to check my stock portfolio instantly. I want to have instant messaging to a friend. We have a sense of a need for speed, but it also increases our sense of the need for speed. Because we can do it fast, well, why can't we do it a little bit faster? So if you're accustomed to writing a letter and having it get there in 3 days and getting a response 3 days later, the fact that it took an extra day might not mean a whole lot. But once you've experienced stuff beyond a certain threshold of speed, you're more and more impatient. Mass media satisfies and evokes our thirst for novelty. On one hand, we're satisfied, but on the other hand, we're dissatisfied. That's one of the points that Todd Gitlin makes in Media Unlimited. He suggests that our experience with mass media encourages us to expect new and intensely exciting emotions that can be quickly forgotten and disposed of. Sounds paradoxical, but we want things that are exciting, that are intense, that reach us immediately, and then we can turn on to the new thing, go on to another thing. It's not so much that mass media delivers us emotions, but it delivers us a way of having emotions, a kind of comportment toward emotion. To grow up in this culture, Gitlin writes, is to grow into an expectation that images and sounds will be there for us on command, and that stories they compose will be succeeded by still other stories, all bidding for our attention, all striving to make sense, all ours, all sovereignly chosen by us. There's an ideal of change. We get used not just to choosing things, but we anticipate choosing new things all the time. We want our pleasures to be intense, but we want them to be fleeting. And we want them to be fleet. The promise of speed, Gitlin writes, is nowhere more fully observed than in the media and the culture of switching that surrounds him. The culture of switching, he's talking obviously about channel zappers and web surfing. If something we're looking at isn't fast enough, we help it get faster by editing the experience to accommodate our restlessness. You know, I open my browser, I got 5 different tabs, I click on this, come back to that one's not there, I go over that one's half there, I can click on that. Again, we want it to be fleeting. In thinking about our media habits, it's not surprising that experts in marketing who advise churches unanimously agree that if you want to attract people to your church, you have to feature music that's new and music that's fast. We live in a world that expects new and fast things, and so that's what Rick Warren or someone says. You have to have new and fast music because that's the kind of thing that people want. Familiar or contemplative music just won't strike a responsive chord in people who prefer the fleet and the fleeting. Now, Gitlin talks about our living in a torrent of images and sounds, and people who have adjusted to living in that torrent, who think the torrent is normal, do find it hard to come in out of the rain. If you're used to being overwhelmed, then experiences that are slow and thoughtful would be underwhelming. That's not surprising. Now, since my undergraduate studies in film studies, I'm most aware of how the modern need for speed combined with new technologies has affected television and film in the past 40 years. And Gitlin comments on this. He says, the most widespread, most consequential speed-up of our time is in the onrush of images, the speed at which they zip through the world, the speed at which they give way to more of the same, the tempo at which they move. If you've ever watched video clips from newscasts of 20 or 30 years ago, you'd be amazed at the differences in pace. First of all, there are no special effects where one image is morphing into another or the screen is being displaced by an image sliding from one side to the other. But just how long the average shot was. In fact, how few computer-generated special effects were used to accompany narration. How relax the programs feel. Earliest television newscasts, the newscasters actually sat at a desk with a globe and some books on it, which is amazingly quaint when you see these things. They were there as teachers, quiet, sedate teachers informing us about things. The pace is just amazing. The news and entertainment programming now on TV, as well as in theaters, the pace is remarkable. The visual density within each shot is also intensified, often enhanced by computer-generated special effects. Gitlin calls this speed on top of speed, the swirling dynamic within a shot and then the edit between one shot and the next. Montage, that is editing, is as restless as the camera is, as relentless as the camera is restless. But in many instances, the camera movement and the quick-cut editing conceals the fact that the images themselves aren't that visually stimulating. One of the reasons there's so much fast-cutting is because the images themselves are inherently boring. You see this particularly if you watch something like the DIY Network, or where they're constantly switching back and forth, because the stuff they're showing isn't that interesting. Here's how Gitlin describes this. It's brilliant. A sequence of images burst like so many firecrackers, but the bits taken one at a time have little to offer. Pictorially, they lack interest. In other words, the pleasure of beholding these freestanding images speeding by is not strictly visual, but amounts to a different sort of pleasure. A subvisual, visceral pleasure at the disorientation that results from a sequence of bursts. Pleasure at immersion in a wild procession of fragments, kind of like a roller coaster ride. You can't really pay attention to the scenery in a roller coaster ride. The thing that the visual cortex perceives is just a blur. It's just a change. So there is a kind of exhilaration in the blur, but it's not because it's visually interesting. It's precisely because you can't see what's happening, which drives those of us who are really interested in images kind of nuts, because we like those Japanese films with long, slow, well-composed shots. This friend of mine says, like watching paint dry. These new video technologies actually affect our brains. There's a book by a psychologist named Richard de Grandpré called Ritalin Nation, in which he cites a number of studies which indicate that the reason kids need Ritalin is because their brains have actually been chemically altered by video games and this kind of the neural pathways as well as the biochemistry has been affected by this intense stream of sensory experience, more intense than anything people have ever known, perhaps outside of combat. In fact, it probably is more intense and more sustained than what people experience in combat. Now, that speed, let's move away from just the sheer kind of biological effect of it. Let's think about the mental and spiritual effect. One French sociologist has suggested that in the media age, the person who kind of excels or kind of rises to, comes to the fore is the person who seems to be a fast thinker. A person who may not be necessarily that thoughtful, but the one who's adept at the snappy phrase, the blustery and authoritative opinion, and the unanswerable statistical put-down. Just watch any of the so-called talk shows on television. You see, you know, there's a kind of dynamic which makes it look like these people are smart, but they're really just kind of smart alecks in a lot of ways. One French critic called this le fast thinker. those French. So the most successful performer isn't the person with the truth, but the one with the sharpest tongue and the handiest numbers. A kind of mentality that's encouraged for the, kind of the snappy put-down. This shows up in TV drama also, where we have a kind of unprecedented glibness for the last 15 years in sitcoms and dramatic shows, where hesitancy or awkwardness is increasingly absent from the lives of characters. And the one-liner put-down particularly, the ironic put-down, is kind of the preferred mode of discourse, a kind of knowingly snide attitude that one critic called the hipness unto death. Now let's take stock of this. In the middle of the chapter that I've been quoting from by Todd Gitlin from Media Unlimited, Todd Gitlin is not a believer of any kind that I know of, a Christian, but he makes this very interesting moral observation. It's hard to arrange your corporeal, marital, occupational, or spiritual life just as you want, to transform your life as rapidly as you like, but you can make images, sounds, texts flow, yield as fast as you please, disconnected but seamless. In other words, our desire for control and speed may be fulfillable in our virtual life, in our mass-mediated life, but how does that affect our attitude toward real life? You can tell Gitlin's nervous about this. If control and speed are so highly cherished, but real life happens slowly and apart from our sovereignty, are we in fact tempted toward impatience or indifference to those around us in favor of a more rewarding relationship with Laura Croft or with short-term celebrities of the latest reality TV series? The desires for control and for speed that our experience with mass media encourages are disordered desires. They're not obviously sinful, but in being disproportionate and unrealistic, they will cause our lives to be misshapen in ways that invite sin. It's not sinful to be in a hurry all the time, but being in a hurry all the time is a fruitful place for sinful things to grow. For example, media saturation tends to make us feel blasé and restless. With a huge repertoire of experiences through media, the been-there-done-that mentality encourages us to seek more and more intense and extreme sensations. I think that's part of the rationale behind extreme sports. Thomas DeZenGatito, who I quoted earlier in his book Mediated, writes of people who conduct themselves so that everything becomes an emergency. People who are, as he puts it, addicted to busyness. People who don't just use their cell phones in public, but display in every nuance of cell phone deportment their sense of throbbing connectedness to something important. I see people like this very often at the airport. I saw a guy the other day, I almost wanted to punch him. Because the way he was treating the woman at the food counter, you know, he's on this call, and obviously the future of the free world depended on his having this phone call and his getting his burger served at the same time. Display in every nuance of cell phone deportment their sense of throbbing connectedness to something important. These people would suffocate like fish on a dock if they were cut off from the flow of events that they have conspired with their fellows to create. To these plugged-in players, the rest of us look like zombies coasting on fumes. For them, the feeling of being busy is the feeling of being alive. Partly it's a function of speed, like in those stress dramas that television provides to keep us virtually busy. And we're not busy enough, so we watch ER, for instance. There's the bloody body wheeled into the ER. Every person Jack on the team yelling numbers from monitors, screaming for meds and equipment, especially for those heart shocker pads. That's the paradigm scene. And all the others derive from it. Hostage negotiator scenes, staffers pulling all-nighters in the West Wing, detectives sweeping out of the precinct, donning jackets, adjusting holsters, snapping wisecracks, sheer speed and lives on the line. That's the recipe for feeling real. Jack Bauer phone home, right? 24 hours. He doesn't even, I don't know if he gets a potty break any time in that whole time. Speed. That's the recipe for feeling real. Now, the irony is that after we worked really hard on something urgent for a long time, we do escape numbness for a while, stepping out of the building, noticing the breeze, the stillness of things in the shop window. During those accidental and transitional moments, we actually do get the feeling of the real that we were so frantically pursuing while we were so busy. But we soon get restless. We can't take the input reduction. Our psychic metabolism craves more. 10 years ago or so, I was asked to write an article for a Christian magazine, and I was told by one of the editors that the readers of the publication were too busy to think through the articles that involved any kind of detail or analysis. They demanded, so the editors assumed, snappy anecdotal writing with a what-can-I-do-now immediacy and practicality. They wanted speed and the promise of control. But immediate practicality can easily be the enemy of wisdom, that is, of long-term, wisely practical living. Wisdom is a virtue acquired only with patient experience. Wisdom demands we detach ourselves from the clamoring demands of the immediate. Seeking after wisdom requires a level of attentiveness and reflection, and waiting on the Lord in the patient exercise of building understanding rather than scrambling for seven-step solutions. Wisdom doesn't come in an instant powdered form. It requires time. It requires steeping or rising or aging or whatever food metaphor you prefer. The ideal suggested by mass media is immediate access to sensational experience, which often has a disposable quality about it. But the character of wisdom is more like that of a precious, well-worn book than of a frenetic, quick-cutting movie or an evening spent channel zapping or cruising the internet. What I've been trying to suggest in this lecture is that the obstacles in our culture to the cultivation of Christian faithfulness aren't simply the product of bad ideas. They're the patterns and contours in the shape of our everyday lives that work against the cultivation of wisdom and obedience. So, if we're committed to the task of becoming wise, of becoming faithful disciples, it's not enough to reject the bad ideas of the time. We have to examine the shape of our everyday lives, the way we live in space and time, and ascertain whether we've crowded wisdom out by aligning ourselves with the disorder of our time. Sabbath observance, media fasts, the avoidance of the temptation to perpetual multitasking are some of the ways we can work against this aspect of the spirit of the age. We need to be more deliberate and more self-conscious about how we engage the world of the media. I quoted Eugene Peterson a couple times. I met Peterson at a conference on technology in the church about 6 or 7 years ago. And he was invited. It was a day-long event with a number of Christian writers, theologians, pastors, and a philosopher of technology named Albert Borgman, who teaches at the University of Montana, who's written brilliant things about how technology affects our lives. And since Eugene Peterson lived a couple of hours away, and since he was served a wonderful career as a very wise pastor, they invited him to join us. And we kept turning to him throughout the day saying, "Oh, Eugene, tell us." It's kind of like turning to Yoda. You know, give us wisdom about how practical counsel about the life of the church in light of these things. And Peterson showed how truly wise he was by keeping his mouth shut most of the day. He didn't say anything. Finally, he talked. And he said, you know, the most important thing I did in the lives of the people in my congregation, in helping them live in a disordered world, the most important thing I did was teach them to take time to worship. He said, we're in such a hurry. Efficiency is such a tyrant. And so I decided, people are always in such a hurry. They want to get through it. And it's not that they're in a hurry to leave the worship service. They just think that if things don't happen fast, it's not going to be productive. So he said, I very deliberately decided that we were going to have leisurely worship. We were going to take time, just in case the Holy Spirit showed up. And we, you know, he didn't say that. That's my comment. So he said, when it came time for me to give a pastoral prayer, instead of jumping up from the seat and starting the prayer right away. I'd count to 5 or 10. Then I'd stand up. And then I'd say, let us pray. And then I'd pause to collect my thoughts and let people collect their thoughts. He said, drove him nuts. He said it took 10 years. It took 10 years to get to the point where people could figure out what was going on and came to love it. And then I talked to him later about this in an interview I did, and he said he had a woman come to him who was leaving the church, who'd become a Christian through his ministry. She said, you know, when I first came to your church, you did something that really, really annoyed me. He said, what was that, take up the offering? She said, no, the thing that really annoyed me was you'd stand up there and you'd say, let us pray. And then you'd stand for 10 minutes. I thought you had a heart attack first time. You didn't jump into the prayer right away. And she says, now that I'm leaving this church, that's the thing I'm going to miss most. Now, when you get up there and you say, let us pray, and then you wait 20 seconds, when you start, I almost want to say, not yet, Eugene. We're still getting there. We're still getting there. Now, that I use that as an anecdote, as a kind of counterpoint to this disorder, this frenetic mentality. Because I think that's exactly the kind of leaning into the wind that pastors and churches need to model. There's a disorder there that all kinds of people feel the disorder. I don't know anybody that's not true. I was going to say, I don't know anybody who likes being in a rush, but in a sense, some people do like being in a rush. It makes them feel important, like the guy with the cell phone. But people often do complain about this. But there's a certain sense in which they're not willing to give up the sense of self-importance and energy that it comes with it. It seems to me that churches are zones of refreshment in a really parched kind of world. Not just with the message that we have, but in how we convey the message and how we show ways of living our life together, ways of coming together before God, that we have this amazing opportunity to present something that really is something that the world does not give. Now, granted, it took Peterson 10 years to do that. I told this story to a friend of mine who's a PCA pastor, and his immediate response was, oh, that's so wise. Then he said, my session would kill me. It's not an easy thing to try to lead in a countercultural way. It's not an easy thing to offer appropriate and wise resistance in those kinds of instances. But I encourage you that are going out of the ministry to consider those opportunities where you see disorders that have painful consequences in people's lives, to figure out ways to work against that, to create habits that really do resist the kinds of idolatries that we face in the forums of our lives. Well, I ended 5 minutes early. That's at least something. Thank you very much.
Let's say we have time for several questions, if there are, perhaps around this idea of restlessness and a pastoral sensitivity to building character and Christ-likeness in the wake of this.
Well, thank you very much for the presentation. I find it fascinating. But I wonder, is there any kind of a growing sense of dissatisfaction in the world with the pace? Does the church have, I hesitate to say an opportunity, but the church has for some time tried to make itself too much like the world, in my opinion. Yes. Is there a chance here for us to show how different we are from the world?
I think there are a lot of churches that do that. I think there are a lot of churches that do that. And I think that's, I've been nervous for years with the phrase seeker sensitive. I appreciate the concern, but part of the problem is how do you define what a seeker is? Because I know a lot of people most of the people I know who are seekers end up in New Age groups. They're looking for something very much unlike the world. Somebody asked me in an interview once, what do you think of seeker-friendly worship services? I said, as long as they're part of martyr-friendly churches, that's fine. In other words, you have to move the seekers beyond that to something really, really different. But I know of churches and pastors and I think there's certainly an opportunity. Again, I'm haunted by Jesus is saying, "Peace I give unto you, not as the world gives, give I unto you." And then, so you want to take the word peace. Well, is there anything else Jesus gives that's not like the world gives? Well, yeah, I think there's a lot. He gives love. He gives contentment. He gives a sense of order in our lives. There are a whole lot of things that Jesus gives that are not as the world gives. And there's always a temptation, and I repeat this over and over, there's always a temptation to assume that what we have is a very small message about salvation, understood in the narrow sense, just getting some mark in a ledger so people avoid hell, as if that's the biblical picture of salvation. The biblical picture of salvation is a picture of a new life, picture of a new life lived in Christ, a new life lived as a human being in God's creation in Christ. That has all kinds of ramifications, and personal and social and cultural ramifications. As long as we understand that we have a really narrow message that's just getting people to sign on the line of a pledge card, and that's all, then it does make sense to kind of conform to the spirit of the age, because you're going to get more, it's easier to get more attention. But there are any day you can meet people who feel some disorder, some dehumanizing disorder that they're right to feel. So if churches can be communities where, now, no church will be perfect, and there'll always be people with disordered lives and disordered affections in churches. That's why they're there. They're there to try to kind of come to terms with that disorder. And none of us sees all of this disorder in our own lives. I mean, none of us is aware of all that. Part of the task of the community of the church is to help, for us to help each other see where that disorder is. I think that as I watched the various movements in the last 25 years or so, there's a sense in which some of the movements, I think that the megachurch movement, in a sense, was a kind of last gasp of a way of presenting the gospel that was in accord with kind of cultural, kind of mainstream cultural dominance. As long as there's a mainstream culture, as long as the culture is generally healthy, that's fine. I gave a lecture years ago at Wheaton College on Billy Graham's ministry, and Billy Graham could call people to repentance because there were all sorts of institutions in the culture. I mean, Reinhold Niebuhr was somebody that cultural leaders listened to, and Reinhold Niebuhr had problems in his theology, but he did believe in sin. And so the message of repentance that Billy Graham preached was a plausible message because people had cultural institutions around them that still conveyed a sense of authority, a sense of the necessity of getting right with God. In a culture where those deep assumptions are no longer in place, the idea of mass evangelism, again, God can do all sorts of things, but the idea of mass evangelism becomes more problematic because the sets of assumptions that people are carrying with them are less and less likely to be anything approaching a Christian understanding. I mean, in a sense, the set of assumptions that the apostles faced was closer to a Christian understanding than the set of assumptions most of our contemporaries have. Most people in the Greco-Roman world knew that some deity had to be appeased, that there was something disordered and some deity had to be appeased. Most people had that sense. So what must I do to be saved was not an odd question to ask. And there's a certain sense in which I don't know that, you know, people saw shrinking churches, people saw more unchurched people. That was the thing that concerned Bill Hybels. Why are they unchurched? Well, it could be that they're unchurched because of the fact that they're living in a culture that has suspicion about authority, has suspicion about community, has kind of indifference to to historical continuity, has indifference to a lot of things that we do, in fact, value. So it's not surprising that that would be the case. But rather than addressing the cultural disorder, you know, some of the strategists have said, well, let's conform to the cultural disorder. Let's present a way of membership that doesn't require any kind of commitment. Let's present church as spectator, as a spectator event. Well, in a sense, I think that's kind of a last gasp. And I wonder whether 20 years from now we'll see churches like that. There'll still be some churches like that. The most successful are the least Christian. I don't think Joel Osteen, I never hear the gospel when I hear Joel Osteen preach. But it's like the biggest, people call it an evangelical church. I've never heard anything about sin and repentance in his preaching. Now maybe people get it somehow. So, and I think the Joel Osteen churches maybe, I think that's where the big church model is heading in something that as somebody described Joel Osteen as, he makes Norman Vincent Peale look like Jonathan Edwards. And I think that's probably sound. As long as the church becomes a chaplaincy to the American way of life, as long as churches see themselves as providing a chaplaincy to an American way of life, and as long as the American way of life becomes more and more confused, you know, gay marriage, polygamy, whatever, you know, then the churches that are providing a chaplaincy to the American way of life are going to be less and less Christian, necessarily. I think in a culture that's becoming more and more post-Christian, everybody's going to look more and more Amish. Every faithful church is going to look more and more Amish. Not deliberately, not because we want to look Amish, but our neighbors are more and more going to think, you guys are weird. Monogamous? What is that? Heterosexual? Where did that come from? Now, not everybody. I bet there are millions and millions of people in this country who still believe that homosexuality is a perversion, but they don't know any place that they can confess that, where they can't, you know, there's no sense of any place where they can say that. So people still, by God's common grace or because of the work of the Spirit, because of conscience, somehow know when things are disordered. Many people do, but if it's not fashionable to recognize the disorder, then it becomes really hard.